And you know, when you see paleoconservative types, as I think, I'm not mischaracterizing Bacevich, I believe he's a paleocon. When you see people like him writing for The Nation, you know, that's just another piece in the pile of evidence that there's a new realignment going on in this country, that the Democrats and Republicans are going to end up on one side and everybody else on the other. I guess it already is that way, but more and more people are realizing it and, you know, putting it into practice in their own lives. But anyway, if I can get through this thing, geez, it's kind of long. I'd like to share this article with you and see if I can get through this whole thing and keep it interesting. If it sounds like I'm losing you in my own ears, then I'll probably give up. But this is the Spotlight article today on antiwar.com. It's called The Semi-Warriors by Andrew J. Bacevich. In books, essays, and op-eds, complaints about presidential power run amok have once again become legion, with the still unfolding saga of the Gonzales 8 the most recent, if hardly the most egregious, example. These complaints derive from a common source, the perceived excesses of the Bush administration, perpetrated under the pretext of prosecuting the global war on terror. Yet as a close reading of the books considered here makes plain, unchecked and unbalanced presidential power is itself not the problem, but merely its outward manifestation. The imperial presidency is not the disease, it is a symptom. To imagine that getting rid of Bush will cure what ails the body politic is akin to assuming that excising a tumor will alone suffice to cure cancer. The real affliction is more insidious. For want of a better label, call it semi-war, a term coined after World War II by James Forrestal to promote permanent quasi-mobilization as the essential response to the permanent global crisis. A man who saw demons everywhere, Forrestal was convinced that he alone grasped the danger they posed to the United States. Forrestal was also a zealot, the prototype for a whole line of national security ideologues stretching across six decades, from Dean Acheson to Donald Rumsfeld, from Paul Neitz to Paul Wolfowitz. Jeffrey Parrott's acerbic description of Acheson applies to them all. His, quote, mind turned to the apocalyptic as easily, if not as often, as other men's thoughts turn toward money or sex. For semi-warriors, time is always short. The need for action is always urgent. The penalty for hesitation always promises to be dire. From Forrestal's day to the present, semi-warriors have viewed democratic politics as problematic. Debate means delay. To engage in give and take or compromise is to forfeit clarity and suggests a lack of conviction. The effective management of national security requires specialized knowledge, a capacity for clear-eyed analysis, and above all, an unflinching willingness to make decisions, whatever the cost. With the advent of semi-war, therefore, national security policy became the preserve of experts, few in number, almost always unelected, habitually operating in secret, persuading themselves that to exclude the public from such matters was to serve the public interest. After all, the people had no demonstrable need to know. In a time of perpetual crisis, the anointed role of the citizen was to be pliant, deferential, and afraid. For Forrestal and other members of the emergent national security elite, fired by the need to confront a never-ending array of looming threats, the presidency served as an accommodating host. Semi-warriors built the imperial presidency. On behalf of the new chief executive, increasingly referred to as the commander-in-chief, they claimed new prerogatives. They created new institutions that became centers of extra-constitutional power, the National Security Council, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the various agencies that make up the intelligence community. When out of office, they inhabited think tanks, consulted, lobbied, and generally raked in the dough, all while positioning themselves for a return to power. They also imprinted on the capital city a new style, one that emphasized perils without precedent, activism on a global scale, and a preference for hard power. In 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt became president, the District of Columbia was merely a seat of government, and the United States was still a republic. When FDR's successor left office 20 years later, Washington fancied itself the center of the universe, with the United States now the self-anointed leader of the free world. As Colin Murphy observes in Are We Rome? The mordantly funny essay filled with arresting observations, this transformation of status fostered large delusions, quote, that the world is small, that society is malleable, that the capital's stance is paramount. To reside in the imperial city was to believe that assertions of will can trump assessments of reality. The world is the way we say it is. Through the first decades of the 20th century, American statecraft, at its best, had been informed by judicious realism. Perhaps, and this is Basevich's words best exemplified by Henry Stimson, who, I don't know why he says that, isn't Stimson the guy who had Truman nuke Japan? Anyway, Secretary of War throughout World War II, by 1945, that realist tradition had just about played itself out. Just 3 weeks after VJ Day, Stimson left Washington for the last time. Forrestal, Stimson's naval counterpart, stayed on, stoking his fevered inclinations. Not long thereafter, the War Department itself, within which war as such had typically figured as an afterthought, gave way to a new Department of Defense. Along with the CIA, DOD became the principal instrument for waging semi-war, its actual purpose having little to do with the defense, defense per se, and everything to do with projecting U.S. military power around the world. That Harry Truman should have appointed Forrestal the first Secretary of Defense seems only fitting. That the job then broke Forrestal, in 1949 he suffered a nervous collapse and committed suicide, might have been seen as a portent, a cosmic repudiation of Forrestal's grand endeavor. Members of the new national security elite chose to see Forrestal's demise in a different light. He had lacked the requisite toughness. So the Pentagon hung Forrestal's portrait in the hallway, named an aircraft carrier in his honor, and promptly forgot him. What destroyed Forrestal was his inability to control the generals and admirals who ran the U.S. military. And now, again, this is Andrew J. Basevich in The Nation writing about the 40s and 50s. At this point, what destroyed Forrestal was his inability to control the generals and admirals who ran the U.S. military. To his considerable chagrin, Truman found himself encountering similar frustrations. As a practical matter, it turned out that the commander-in-chief enjoyed only a limited capacity to command. Already in the late 40s, the apparatus created within the executive branch to assist the president in conducting semi-war manifested a will of its own. Presidents could set events in motion without bothering to secure congressional authorization. Truman committed U.S. forces to Korea in 1950, and later that year made the fateful decision to send them north of the 38th parallel. But having done so, writes Jeffrey Parrott, he was, quote, no more the master of his fate than a leaf tumbling down the street in the wind. This point forms a central theme of Parrott's Commander-in-Chief. Semi-warriors evince great confidence in their ability to manage events. When they miscalculate, the president is left holding the bag, and the American people are left to foot the bill. Despite his no-nonsense, take-no-guff, buck-stops-here manner, Truman was as much a creature of the imperial presidency as its directing officer. The most powerful man in the world exercised only limited control over the national security apparatus that provided the ostensible foundation of his authority. Others set the tune to which the man in the Oval Office danced. In Presidential Power, Matthew Crenson and Benjamin Ginsburg quote Clark Clifford, a key Truman aide, to explain how the process worked. Clifford and other members of the White House staff would arrive at, quote, some understanding among ourselves on what direction we would like to see the president take on any given issue. Having reached their decision, Truman's nominal subordinates would, quote, quietly and unobtrusively try to steer the president in that direction. In short, as the atmosphere of semi-war took hold in the later 1940s, the formulation of national security policy became less democratic, but it did not become less political. It's just that the politics became an insider's game, shielded from public security. Henceforth, the politicking that counted occurred within the presidency, behind closed doors. Keeping the Joint Chiefs on board became more important than gaining the assent of Congress. Maintaining a consensus among the various entities represented on the National Security Council took precedence over attending to what was once called the common good. The events of 9/11 endowed semi-war with a new lease on life, that the crisis touched off by the events of September 11, 2001 will continue in perpetuity has become an article of faith. Politicians now talk of peace the way cynical preachers speak of the second coming. Paying homage to the idea remains an obligation, but only rubes take such stuff seriously. No credible presidential candidate in either party has dared to question the wisdom or necessity of waging the global war on terror. Like the poor, apparently the GWAT, or as some style it, the Long War, promises to be with us always. In Unchecked and Unbalanced, Frederick Schwartz Jr. and Aziz Huck tabulate the chilling byproducts of this sort of groupthink. Among the most egregious, Justice Department memos justifying torture, the blizzard of signing statements in which President Bush claims the prerogative of selectively disregarding the law, domestic surveillance implemented on a scale without precedent, the open-ended imprisonment of detainees, including American citizens, without charge, and a program of extraordinary rendition that secretly delivers suspected terrorists into the hands of foreign intelligence services for interrogation. Schwartz and Huck are especially good at describing the exertions by the Bush administration to cloak these actions with a tissue of legality. Richard Nixon once declared, "If the president orders it, that makes it legal." The lawyers in the Bush Justice Department, with John Yoo, formerly the Office of Legal Counsel, playing a leading role, expanded on the Nixon doctrine. The resulting Yoo doctrine goes something like this: if the president wants to do it, creative lawyering can contrive an argument that empowers him to do so. In the book Presidential Power, Crenson and Ginsburg point out that the problem is not so much presidents seizing power as having it handed to them. As Americans increasingly embrace a minimalist definition of citizenship, their ability to influence government policy diminishes. With its, quote, weak political parties, its partially demobilized electorate, and its citizens transformed into mere customers of government, they write, contemporary America, quote, is made to order for presidentialism. In this regard, the transformation of the relationship between the U.S. military and the American people since Vietnam has proved crucial. Credit the original insight to Nixon during Vietnam's latter stages. Reliance on citizen soldiers can impose constraints when it comes to using force. And I don't believe he's making an argument for conscription here. He's simply analyzing what happened. An army made up of professionals, a military detached from society, could well enhance presidential freedom of action. Nixon's creation of a so-called all-volunteer force met with the enthusiastic approval of Americans eager to shed any responsibility for contributing to the nation's defense, especially if that responsibility, which should be in ironic quotes there, carried with it the prospect of being shipped to some godforsaken outpost in Southeast Asia. Without anyone taking much notice, Americans forfeited ownership of their army. The armed forces became the property of the commander-in-chief to be used as he sees fit, a proposition that has long since received tacit congressional endorsement. In practice, when it comes to climbing aboard the bandwagon bound for war, few members of Congress will risk being left behind. As a consequence, writes Crenson and Ginsburg, quote, America's military ventures abroad now rely on a relatively small and insulated force of regulars, whose deployment and casualties produce barely a ripple on Main Street. This might be tolerable if presidentialism yielded effective policy, but it doesn't. The overall performance of semi-warriors since the rise of the national security state qualifies at best as mixed. Since 9/11, it has been nothing short of disastrous. There's that word again, disastrous. Boy, that word gets used a lot in the show. Peretz's commander-in-chief offers a dangerous... pardon me. Peretz's commander-in-chief offers an angry but highly readable account of how Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam and George W. Bush in Iraq repeated the blunders committed by Harry Truman in Korea. Peretz portrays each of these conflicts as unnecessary and unwinnable. Each case featured a set of advisors keen to demonstrate their masculinity by sending other people's children, American soldiers, off to fight. In each instance, a president out of his depth and ill-equipped to exercise independent judgment did as his advisors urged, with tragic results. When it comes to exposing the deficits of U.S. policy since 2001, Stephen Holmes' book, The Matador's Cape, a collection of previously published essays, is especially devastating. Even many Republican stalwarts now acknowledge that when it comes to sustained ineptitude, the Bush administration takes the blue ribbon. Holmes goes further, exposing the profound irrationality and the acute narcissism informing the administration's response to September 11th. There is a great irony here. The semi-warriors surrounding Bush had spent the Clinton years carping about the absence of strategic coherence. Their own moment having arrived, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and company embarked on a reckless course so fraught with contradictions as to make Bill Clinton appear the very model of a prudent statesman. Quote, "The fate of the country," writes Holmes, "was abandoned to the personal eccentricities, obsessions, compulsions, and tunnel vision of a handful of political operatives. Chief among those personal eccentricities was a disdain for history. Preeminent among the obsessions was a devout faith in the efficacy of military power. Looming large among the compulsions was an itch to have another go at Saddam Hussein, not because he was strong and posed a danger, but because he was weak and represented an opportunity." According to Holmes, quote, "The administration viewed Iraq less as a threat than as a showcase. The purpose of unleashing American firepower in Iraq was not so much to take out a cruel but puny dictator, but rather to advertise the folly of defying the United States. The big lie propagated by the architects of the Iraq War is not that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, nor that he was in cahoots with Osama bin Laden. It is that they possessed a secret formula for keeping America safe, the essential ingredient in that formula being a mandate to engage in open-ended war. Although the semi-warriors advising Bush fancied they had discovered something original, they were really peddling the same elixir concocted by James Forrestal some six decades ago. Having drunk deeply of that elixir, President Bush is now left holding the bag, with others, chiefly young soldiers and their families, picking up the tab. Will the errors and excesses of the Bush administration spell the demise of the imperial presidency? Don't count on it. Democrats bemoan the failures of the Bush administration, and with good cause, yet none of the Democrats vying to replace President Bush is doing so with the promise of reviving the system of checks and balances. In this regard, the views of Republicans and Democrats align precisely. The aim of the party out of power is not to cut the presidency down to size, but to seize it. Not to reduce the prerogatives of the executive branch, but to regain them. In Washington and in national politics more generally, the Schlesinger rule remains sacrosanct. Named in honor of the late Arthur Schlesinger Jr., eminent historian and on-again, off-again enthusiast of presidential activism, the rule goes like this. When the other party does it, it's an abuse of power. When my own party does it, it's dynamic leadership. The press plays the role of enabler. Having had a field day recording President Bush's triumphal procession from one spectacular blunder to the next, with Iraq, Katrina, and now Walter Reed vying for top honors, reporters can't be bothered to assess the implications of these gaffes. Are they already turning to the next big story, handicapping the imperial succession? Is it Hillary's turn? Will Obama's allure last? Can McCain and Giuliani sell themselves to the Christian right? For as long as members of the media can recall, the presidency has been the biggest story in town. They have a vested interest in preserving it. But in their contempt for politicians and journalists, Americans should not be too quick to let themselves off the hook. Any serious effort to reduce the presidency to its pre-imperial proportions would imply rethinking the premises of American foreign policy, based on self-aggrandizing assumptions about American wisdom, competence, and prerogatives, and about the capacity of others to manage their own affairs. Given our chronic inability, or is it unwillingness, to see the world as it is and to see ourselves as we really are, such a reassessment seems exceedingly unlikely. In an age of the citizen as consumer spectator, Americans care enough to complain, but not nearly enough to act. Long live the Emperor. That was The Semi-Warriors by Andrew J. Basevich. It's currently the spotlight article at antiwar.com today. It's from The Nation magazine. And again, Andrew J. Basevich is the author of The New American Militarism. How or why, I forget, Americans, I guess how Americans are seduced by war, which is an incredible read in and of itself. And boy, wasn't that a good article? I'm sorry, I'm not the best at reading out loud on the radio, but there are others who are worse. I've heard them, so. And be glad I'm good at picking out which articles to read. And I dare say that the man's right, that it's all Harry Truman's fault. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt before him, particularly Truman and the National Security Act of 1947. That was the death knell. And now I think I remember somewhere Truman saying that he regretted signing the National Security Act, that it was the biggest mistake of his life, whatever. But yeah, too little too late for you, Harry Newcomb Keel Hall. Nationalize the steel mills, start a war without Congress, Truman. So yeah, the way that article ends, I think, that's the important part. And you know, I guess that thing applies to me too. He says we're all willing, or all of us, some of us at least, are willing to complain about it, but not willing to do anything about it. But that's a little vague, isn't it? I don't know what to do about it except complain about it. I guess I could, you know, try to get a few friends and go join a political party or something, but I don't have any faith that that would do any good for anyone. Well, I could see it wasting a lot of my precious time. So, you know, I don't know. You know, I did meet a guy one time who said that, you know, hey, pal, if you and your 15 friends just picked a political party, the Republicans or the Democrats, either one, and just decided that you were going to seize the local precinct, you could do it. All you'd have to do is take your 10 friends down there, outvote everybody, seize the precinct. And then from there, you know, get a few more like-minded people together. In no time at all, you could seize the state committees and whatever, whatever. And purge all the pro-war evil people who hate the Bill of Rights out of the parties and have your way with them. And he said it was easy. That he'd done it. That was one of his jobs was, you know, helping politicians get elected or whatever when he was in college as an intern or whatever it was. He said it was really easy. That's all you got to do is, you know, get a little conspiracy together, get some people on your side, and march down there and take them bastards over. And I guess it seems like it's possible, except it's kind of like the slaves in the mine who all have picks and shovels and outnumber the guards, you know, 15-1. But the guards have shotguns. So the slaves, you know, if they all rush the guards, could free themselves. But a few guys at the front of the line are going to have to take those shotgun blasts. And so nobody wants to be the first guy. I surely don't feel like wasting my life down at a Republican or Democratic Party, you know, headquarters thing, debating with these idiots. But he's right, though. We abdicate. It's not just Congress that abdicates their authority to the president. It's the American people. I mean, we, the American culture, our society, we act like the president is a uber congressman, right? He's all of our congressmen. Most of us don't even know the name of our congressman, but we know that we all know the president. And it's great, isn't it, just to have all your government consolidated into one human being. That way, that way you don't have to pay attention to a bunch of other people and what they're doing and thinking and up to. You can just watch that one guy and he can get all the credit and a 90% approval rating when things go right or in some cases spectacularly wrong or, when things go, other flavors of spectacularly wrong, you can put all the blame on him and the rest of the state gets away scot-free. So I don't know. I'm not much of the call for action thing, you know, I'm not much of a rabble rouser. If people will, you know, feel like, figuring out something they can do about it and doing so, great. If you just want to tune in and listen, that's okay too. you know, whatever. But we should do some phone calls here. The number is 512-646-6446, 512-646-6446. And I'm going to get a 1-800 number for all the out-of-town people to call in for free. But I don't have it yet, so what the hell, man? Cell phones are free. 512-646-6446. But I see my friend Shauna's on the phone here, so let's go ahead and bring her up. Hi, Shauna.
Hey, Scott.
How you doing?
Hey, this is real quick, but I wanted to point out that technique you talked about of taking over the local precincts, that is reportedly how the Christian crazies took over the Republican Party.
Right.
They went to precinct meetings and they actually stayed there, tied up the meetings with just crap until everybody got tired and sleepy and went home. And then when all the regular people had gone home, the crazies just started passing resolutions.
Yep.
That's really all I had to say. I just wanted to point out to people that was really what was going on.
Cool. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
And, you know, she's right about that. I remember, I forget if it was Frontline. I think it probably was Frontline did a thing about. And, you know, when she says the crazies, I don't think she's talking about all Christians. She's talking about the premillennialist, reconstructionist, dispensationalist, something or other, rapturist, weirdos, the Republican Party now. yeah, that's how they did it. They just went down to opened up the rule book and said, okay. You know, really all you need is like, what, somebody's wife to like sit down with her little chart and organize the telephone tree and get people together, you know, the open conspiracy, right? To paraphrase H.G. Wells, one world communist, get a bunch of people together and go down there and take over the local party. It would help if, you have friends at Lockheed to bankroll you. And that's what it really comes down to, isn't it? That, there's 300 million of us. There's 435 house districts all across the country. And yet a very few corporations have the power to bankroll these politicians and decide who wins, or at least decide which two we get to choose from in most of these house elections and obviously all the Senate and presidential elections. It's a real shame. But, you know, I think just the basic concepts of citizenship in the most general sense. If everybody just leaves it to somebody else, then, you know, guess what happens? It gets left to Dick Cheney. You know? And then when the so-called opposition's in power, they're represented by Nancy Pelosi. Ooh. Yeah. And Basevich is right, you know. It's fun to blame them, but we got to take responsibility ourselves. And I guess I'm as guilty as the rest of them, you know? I can't imagine going down and trying to take over one of the other parties or having... or even attempting to have the slightest influence in them. Nobody wants a anti-gun control guy, anti-welfare state guy in the Democratic Party. And nobody wants a gold standard, anti-deficit, anti-war, you know, Bill of Rights guy in the Republicans. I'd have to bring 1,000 of my closest friends, you know, just to take over a local precinct, I bet. Anyway... So that's that. We got to talk about Iran. There's so much important news about Iran, y'all. And I've been slacking here. Well, I haven't been slacking. I've been working real hard to bring you that great Andrew Basevich article. Here, we'll start with this. Tony Blair, he got his 15 sailors and Marines back. This is from The Independent. Blair attacks Iran. That's a figure of speech. As Basra deaths overshadow the hostages' return. It was meant to be a day to celebrate the homecoming of the hostages from Iran. Rejoice, said Tony Blair. Jesus Christ. You know, you remember Bugs Bunny when you were a little kid? And I don't know if it would ever be Bugs, but, you know, one character or another would be up on the stage and like a big cane, like a hook, would come from off stage and grab them by the neck and yank them off. That's what I always picture happening to Tony Blair when he says something with his mouth. Rejoice, said Tony Blair. But then came the dark shadow of Iraq. 4 British soldiers, 2 of them women, killed and another severely wounded in a roadside ambush in Basra. The attack, in which a Kuwaiti interpreter was also killed, shattered whatever hopes had emerged of better relations with Iran following the release of British prisoners. Huh? I know what you're thinking. What the fuck does that have to do with Iran? Some British soldiers got killed in Iraq? What does that have to do with Iran? The Prime Minister directly linked the Tehran regime to killings of British soldiers in Iraq, accusing it of backing, financing, arming terrorism. Well, that's a little vague. Senior UK military officers and diplomats have for months accused Iran of supplying Shia insurgents in Iraq with sophisticated explosive devices and have been used to kill and maim British and American soldiers. The Iranians have denied the claims and have turned accused British agents of carrying out bombings on its territory. Of course, we have Brian Ross from ABC News reporting of American terrorists carrying out attacks in Iran. That'd be the first I'd heard of British agents doing the same, if those accusations are true. But, you know, with Tony Blair, he's guilty until proven innocent. So, this goes on with, you know, the personal stories of the dead soldiers. Four British dead in Iraq, and Tony Blair turns around and points the finger at Iran. And then wants us to conflate and confuse the Sunni insurgency and the Shiite militias, all of which are backed by the United States and Britain. You know, people say, oh, well, America's going up against the Mahdi Army. The Mahdi Army, we're not backing them. Yeah, we are too. The Mahdi Army is the default army of the Dawa Party. You know, as in the Prime Minister, Nari al-Maliki, from the Dawa Party. Muqtada al-Sadr is a major part of the Shiite coalition, and so is the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and their Badr Brigades. And most of the rest of these different Shiite militias are under them. And those are the guys, particularly Skiri and Dawa, those are the guys Iran is backing. They're not picking a fight with America. The roadside bombs are set off by the Sunni insurgents, not by the Shiites. And yes, in fact, when I spoke with Wayne White, the former State Department intelligence officer here on this very show, he said, yeah, you know, there have been a few killings here and there with roadside bombs in Shiite areas. And so, you know, you have individuals who you never know where they score a bomb or what have you. But the idea that somehow there's this organized Iranian effort to back Shiite insurgents. That's an oxymoron, right? This whole time, remember the terminology they've been using this whole time. You know, let's keep our jargon straight here. The insurgency is led by the Ba'athists and the local Sunni community leaders, the imams in the Sunni parts of Iraq. The Kurds in the north, they're Sunnis too, but they're Kurds, not Arabs. They're going along. The Shiites in the south are Arabs, but they're Shiites, not Sunnis. And they're going along with us too. And the political Shiites, the Shiites who have taken power in the south of Iraq, are all backed by Iran. The people that America has installed in power are all backed by the United States and Iran. At the very same time, they are not at war against American or British soldiers. They are trying to lie you into war again. Simple logic, even without, you know, brand new facts in front of you. Simple logic and basic outline of what's happening in Iraq ought to tell you that they are being so deliberately vague in order to make a lie true. Iran backs terrorists. Oh, yeah, that's quite a statement. Which terrorists? Where? And against who? And why? Iran backs the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawa Party, the same people that America backs in Iraq. So don't give me that shit, Tony Blair, you liar. Can anybody think of any examples of Tony Blair being a liar? Right. Hundreds of them, right? They just come flooding in. It's hard to keep them out. Just open your mind up a little bit, that long-term memory, and like, oh yeah, Iraq can bomb London with germ weapons in 45 minutes. Remember that one? Was that the one that they lifted from the USC student's thesis paper there? Yeah. So there you have it, the British soldiers released, and of course... There are big problems for Tony Blair, of course, because he said it was a proven fact and produced a fake map that pretty much all media in America endorsed, saying that the Brits were clearly in Iraqi waters where somehow they had the right to be, I don't know. Apparently that's not the case. And now that the British soldiers are out, Sky News, the British Fox News, basically Rupert Murdoch's news organization, has come out with this story that they had before these Brits were taken captive. They held the story while the Brits were captive in Iran in order to protect their safety, etc. But once all 15 had left Iranian airspace, from Sky News, quote, the captain in charge of the 15 Marines detained in Iran has said they were gathering intelligence on the Iranians. Sky News went on patrol with Captain Chris Eyre and his team in Iraqi waters close to the area where they were arrested just 5 days before the crisis began. We withheld the interview until now so it would not jeopardize their safety. And today, former Iranian diplomat Dr. Mehrdad Kansari said if the Iranians had known about it, they would have used it to justify taking the Marines captive and put them on trial. Pardon me. And put them on trial. So that's the mirror explaining why they held the story. Captain Eyre and his team were on an interaction patrol where their patrol boats came alongside fishing dhows. The operation was mainly to investigate arms smuggling and terrorism, but Captain Eyre said it was also to gain intelligence on Iranian activity. He told Sky correspondent Jonathan Samuels, quote, basically, we speak to the crew, find out if they have any problems, let them know we're here to protect them, protect their fishing, and stop any terrorism and piracy in the area, he said. Secondly, it's to gather intelligence. If they do have any information, it's because they're here for days at a time. They can share it with us, whether it's about piracy or any sort of Iranian activity in the area. Obviously, we're right by the buffer zone with Iran, end quote. The UK Defense Secretary Des Brown told Sky News it was important to gather intelligence to keep our people safe. Oh, really? After a week of denying that that's what they were doing at all? Oh, okay. He said, modern military operations all have an element of gathering intelligence. Blah, blah, blah. So, there's the thing. As I explained on the show already, former British Ambassador Craig Murray has explained that there is no line in the water there. There is only an agreed-upon land border. There is not a water border. And the line is disputed at best. And so regardless of where the boats were, unless they were, you know, within just a mile of the shore either way or what have you, they were in disputed waters. And then, secondly, the position of where those boats were is still suspicious and in dispute. But so much for the story that these guys were just collecting taxes on cars being imported to Iraq. No, they were indeed collecting intelligence on Iran. And this is just another example of America and Britain both attempting to pick a fight with Iran, trying to have a war with Iran. I'm sure y'all remember from the Downing Street memos that got no press in the United States but did everywhere else in the world, where they said, and obviously you all read the foreign news every day, right? And basically it was the minutes of a meeting between the head of MI6 and the head of the CIA and guys on the National Security Council, the vice president's office, etc. And then he came back to the United Kingdom and gave a briefing to Tony Blair saying, you know, this is the deal. And he said, the plan is we're going to bomb Iran, we're going to bomb Iraq. This is from July of 2002. We're going to bomb Iraq, and the facts and the intelligence are being fixed around the policy. Remember that? Well, one of the plans in there, they had option A and option B for starting this war. Option A was a massive buildup and, you know, some threatening TV announcements and then a full-scale invasion. Option B was a running start. And it was proposed at this meeting between Richard Dearlove, George Tenet, and people in the National Security Council and the White House that they would paint a U-2 spy plane in UN colors and get it shot down over Iraq in order to say, see, Saddam Hussein started the war against us. He's such an aggressor. Now we're defending ourselves as we invade. They were prepared to do that and, you know, for whatever reason decided not to. But this is the exact kind of thing that we're seeing in Iran right now. We are a border incident away as they say at antiwar.com, from a conflict between our country and Iran. And God knows who after that. Because if we bomb Iran, that's the kind of thing that surely could spread. So thankfully, here we are at the end of the British sailor capture crisis thing, and no one was able to make a real Gulf of Tonkin incident out of it. But remember, there were two Gulf of Tonkin incidents. One of them that really happened, that was minor and was retaliation for covert activities that had been taking place the day before. And then the second was purely the fantasy, the mistaken hearing of some idiot on a patrol boat who mistook the sound of his own propeller for incoming torpedoes. And everybody at the White House and everybody at the Pentagon knew that by the evening, but they decided to lie and pretend that the second Gulf of Tonkin attack was real anyway and use it as an excuse to escalate the war in Vietnam. And, of course, there are many more examples in history. But wouldn't it just be perfect from the point of view of George Bush for some incident in the Persian Gulf or on the Iranian-Iraqi border to escalate into the kind of thing that would give him the excuse to bomb Iran? That's what they're pushing for. In this case, as Justin Raimondo wrote today on antiwar.com, their provocation backfired, just made Bush and Blair look like clowns, and gave Ahmadinejad the high ground, which, you know, I guess, you know, you could blame me and say, oh, come on, look at you giving, you know, moral equivalence between us and Iran and whatever. But, you know, I'm not. I'm just like a dispassionate observer here, guys. And, you know, I think the consensus is in the world press that Ahmadinejad 1, Bush Blair 0, at least in terms of this capture thing, that he's coming out smelling like roses, and America and Great Britain are coming across like, you know, the Soviet Empire or something in terms of public opinion around the world. That's really got to show you where we're at. And, well, and in fact, for those who heard this show, for those who didn't hear the show yesterday, you missed a great one by Jim Loeb, which was on the frontline section of antiwar.com yesterday. It's in the Jim Loeb archives at antiwar.com, about how America's confidence, the American people's confidence in our government's foreign policy is at an all-time low. Absolute rejection across the board of this government's policies in dealing with the world. And part of that was that now, finally, some incredible majority of the American people finally have gotten it through their thick skull that the rest of the population of the planet Earth is pretty pissed off at us right now. In no small part due to the re-election of George Bush in 2004. Finally, people understand that, and, you know, hopefully it's not too late. But I promised to discuss this Brian Ross story. I brought this up a couple of days ago here on the show. Oh, by the way, did I not mention in the last little while that this is Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, streaming live at KAOS959.com? Because it is. I'm Scott Horton. And Brian Ross wrote on The Blotter, which is the ABC News investigative blog. Oh, and I should give out the phone number, too, if anybody wants to call in real quick. It's 646-6446, 646-6446. For out of town, those streaming live, it's 512-646-6446. And in any case, yeah, so Brian Ross at ABC News, they have this blog, which is not really a blog in terms of, you know, a little sloppier than real journalism or whatever. It's, you know, quality investigative reporting, as good as you can get from ABC News anyway. And check out, this is some earth-shattering shit. I might as well bring it up again. A Pakistani tribal militant group responsible for a series of deadly guerrilla raids inside Iran has been secretly encouraged and advised by American officials since 2005, U.S. and Pakistani intelligence sources tell ABC News. The group, called Jundullah, is made up of members of the Baluchi tribe and operates out of the Baluchistan province in Pakistan, just across the border from Iran. It has taken responsibility for the deaths and kidnappings of more than a dozen Iranian soldiers and officials. U.S. officials say the U.S. relationship with Jundullah is arranged so that the U.S. provides no funding to the group, which would require an official presidential order or finding, as well as congressional oversight. Tribal sources tell ABC News that money for Jandala is funneled to its youthful leader, Abd el-Malik Reji, through Iranian exiles who have connections with European and Gulf states. Jandala has produced its own videos showing Iranian soldiers and border guards it says has captured and brought back to Pakistan. The leader, Reji, claims to have personally executed some of the Iranians. He used to fight with the Taliban. He's part drug smuggler, part Taliban, part Sunni activist, said Alexis DeBatt, a senior fellow on counterterrorism at the Nixon Center and an ABC News consultant who recently met with Pakistani officials and tribal members. Quote, Reji is essentially commanding a force of several hundred guerrilla fighters that stage attacks across the border into Iran on Iranian military officers, Iranian intelligence officers, kidnapping them, executing them on camera, DeBatt said. Most recently, Jandala took credit for an attack in February that killed at least 11 members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards riding on a bus in the Iranian city of Zedan. Last month, Iranian state television broadcast what it said were confessions by those responsible for the bus attack. They reportedly admitted to being members of Jandala and said they had been trained for the mission at a secret location in Pakistan. The Iranian TV broadcast is interspersed with the logo of the CIA, which the broadcast blamed for the plot. A CIA spokesman said the account of alleged CIA action is false and reiterated that the U.S. provides no funding of the Jandala group. Pakistani government sources say the secret campaign against Iran by Jandala was on the agenda when Vice President Dick Cheney met with Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf in February. A senior U.S. government official said groups such as Jandala have been helpful in tracking down al-Qaeda figures and that it was important for the U.S. to deal with such groups in that context. Some former CIA officers say the arrangement is reminiscent of how the U.S. government used proxy armies funded by other countries, including Saudi Arabia, to destabilize the government of Nicaragua in the 1980s. Well, we saw what regime change got us in Iraq. I'm sure it'll work out just fine in Iran. And, keep that story in mind when the war breaks out and it's somehow blamed on Iran. That America's already at war with them. America's already supporting terrorist groups that are using bombs to murder people in Iran. They're already using the Mujahideen al-Khalq. They're using these Jandala kooks. They're using some Azeris, according to some reports. The war with Iran has already begun. And it's as long as the Congress remains in the hands of the Republicans and the Democrats, which I don't see anything that's going to change that anytime soon, there is no opposition in Washington, D.C. that can stop George Bush from doing this. You would think that having an approval rating that never rises above 31% would be enough to restrain the president from having another war, but I'm not so certain that's the case, my friends. Remember, in the last defense appropriations bill, they had a section in there that said, Mr. President, you can't bomb Iran unless you come back to us first and ask permission from us first. And Nancy Pelosi took it out. Why? Because AIPAC told her to take it out. So she took it out. You can read all about it in the New York Sun. Eli Lake wrote all about it. Let's see. I covered that. And I guess I don't have too much time to get into this, but I wanted to mention here pretty quick. Noam Chomsky has an article that's featured today on antiwar.com and on lewrockwell.com. It's a Tom Dispatch article. That is, he wrote it with an introduction by Tom Englehart at tomdispatch.com. And Noam Chomsky writes, what if Iran had invaded Mexico? And he sets up the scenario here. I'm not going to read it to you, but he sets up the scenario that, okay, what if Iran had invaded Mexico and Canada, were building up a giant military presence in the Caribbean, and were threatening us and demanding that we shut down all of our nuclear programs, including our weapons and everything else? How would we react? And you know, not only because the power of our two countries is so vastly different, is that kind of scenario so far-fetched. I don't know if there's anybody out there who thinks Iran has any real global power at all. They don't. They don't have a Navy that could even get to North America, okay, in case anybody was confused about that. Again, picking on a country that can't really fight back, I guess in the region they can. But the other reason that putting the shoe on the other foot, so to speak, in this Chomsky article is so notable is because it really reveals the double standard of American policy in all its bloody, glaring hypocrisy. How can it be that we demand that we are a sovereign nation, that the United Nations and the rest of the people of the world can't push us around and tell us what to do, while at the same time we assert that we can push them around, tell them what to do? You know, if they run the red light, we give them a big fat ticket. But we can run the red light all we want, right in front of everybody, with impunity. You know, only in this case, you know, that's my little cop analogy, but in this case, it's much worse, right? Because we're talking about waging aggressive war here. But basically, you know, if you think back to the run-up to the war against Iraq, it was all in the name of enforcing United Nations resolutions that said that Saddam Hussein wasn't allowed to have these weapons and et cetera, et cetera. He was a rogue state. He wasn't going along with the international community. And if the UN wasn't willing to enforce their own resolutions, by golly, we will. But just think about that. What would it be like if Iran had conquered Mexico and Canada, had a massive navy and army and air force presence in our neighboring countries with puppet dictatorships in each, were staging raids into those countries to abduct our top intelligence officials, as was reported by Patrick Coburn in the Independent on April 3rd, the botched U.S. raid that led to the hostage crisis. How would we feel? Would we not be itching for a war? Would we not actually in that circumstance be justified even in waging a preemptive war against this aggressive Iranian enemy? I think we would. And so take the shoes off and put them back on their proper feet again. This is what the United States is doing to Iran. We've got them completely surrounded, and we're making unreasonable demands. And they're no threat to us at all. It's got to make you wonder, what's the point? But the last little bit here to wrap up this hour on Iran, I will end with the optimism of Gareth Porter. I don't know if he would call it that, but Gareth Porter, he's been a guest on this show before and is a great reporter. In fact, he's the guy who did the best job, I believe, of reporting on the story of how Iran tried to offer peace in 2003. They basically put everything on the table, their nuclear program, their support for Hamas and Hezbollah, recognition of Israel, oil concessions, everything they put on the table, and the United States told them to go to hell. Not only did the United States tell them to go to hell, they told the Swiss ambassador who delivered the message to go to hell. Real classy. The Republican adults who run this government now. Bush's bluster on Iran was cover for direct talks, says Gareth Porter. And in fact, when he was on the show last, he said, nah, let's talk about wars for the rubes to, you know, for Bush's base that wants him to go to war against Iran. But in reality, in Gareth Porter's perception, neocons are out mostly, and Bush is, in fact, despite rhetoric, is in fact going to go ahead and run with the Baker panel recommendations, such as talking with Iran and Syria. So here goes Gareth Porter. This is featured today, by the way, at antiwar.com. When the George W. Bush administration launched the high-profile campaign in January and February, accusing Iran of exporting armor-piercing bombs to Shiite militias in Iraq, seizing Iranian officials in Iraq, threatening cross-border raids against Iran, and sending a second carrier battle group into the Gulf, it seemed that it was entering a much more aggressive phase of Middle East policy. A few weeks later, however, it is apparent that the administration's earlier bluster was primarily for domestic political purposes, to reduce the sense that the administration had lost control over Iraq and the Middle East, and to provide political cover for a move to open direct talks with Iran. The Bush administration sought such direct talks with Iran because its need for Iranian cooperation to help resolve the Sunni-Shiite civil war in Iraq had become increasingly acute. The shift toward talking with Iran began in late February, when the Bush administration reversed its earlier position of refusing to participate in any talks with Iran until it agreed to suspend the uranium enrichment program. It agreed to participate in a regional security conference organized by the Iraqi government in which Iran would also participate. After that decision was announced, an unnamed senior administration official told the New York Times that the State Department was pushing for ways to talk to Iran and Syria, but that the administration did not want to appear to be talking to either country from a position of weakness. In the past 2 weeks, the Bush administration has signaled its keen interest in talks with Iran by its failure to make an issue of the Iranian seizure of 15 British soldiers and Marines in what the British said was Iraqi territorial waters on March 21st. In contrast to its seemingly confrontational approach to Iran in January and February, the administration chose not to exploit the incident to increase tensions. On March 27th, Defense Secretary Robert Gates gave a speech on Middle East policy that failed to make any reference to the issue, but did hint strongly at a desire for talks with Iran. In the speech, Gates called the regional security talks in Baghdad a good start toward improved cooperation, and added that the United States is open to higher-level exchanges. In what appeared to be a rationale for diplomatic engagement with Iran on Iraq, Gates insisted that Iran, like other neighboring countries, is invested and involved to some degree or another in Iraq. He said Iran and Syria needed to play a constructive role going forward, even if they haven't done so in the past, and referred in particular to encouraging political reconciliation and a reduction in violence within Iraq. Gates not only didn't bring up the Iranian detention of British military personnel, but also failed to make the issue of alleged Iranian supply of weapons to Shiite militias. A month earlier, State Department spokesman Sean McCormick had said those weapons would certainly be at the top of our list in any meetings attended by Iran. The Bush White House exercised similar restraint on the British-Iranian conflict in the Gulf for 10 days. The White House did not comment on the issue until Bush responded to a question from reporters at Camp David on March 31st by calling for the immediate and unconditional release of the British sailors and Marines. But Bush refused to suggest what the British should do about it, much less what he could do, what he would do, if it were U.S. military personnel captured by Iranians. And the administration continued to avoid any statement that could be interpreted as raising tensions with Iran right up to the time the sailors were released. Well, that's not the way the Globe and Mail has it from the other day, but continuing. The new interest in talks with Iran stands in stark contrast with the administration's public attitude of dismissal of the value of such talks with Iran in late 2006 and early 2007. In an interview with the Washington Post editorial board on December 14th, Rice suggests that talks with Iran would make no difference to Iranian policy toward Iraq. She further argued that the price of getting Iranian help on Iraq through negotiations would be an Iranian nuclear weapon, and insisted that's not a price that's worth paying. Jesus Christ. Anyway, yeah, so I'm going to stop there. It goes on like that. That's Gareth Porter today from antiwar.com. Bush's bluster on Iran was cover for direct talks. So Gareth Porter apparently perceiving that Bush is sort of going with the Baker panel recommendations here, trying to tone down the heat between the United States and Iran rather than push us toward war. But, you know, who knows who's really in control? I guess it's just Dick Cheney, and who knows what the hell that crazy guy thinks about what should be done about anything. So I don't know. But we'll be right back. I'm going to play this song for y'all real quick, and we'll be back. Got a couple of phone calls lined up. The number is 646-6446-646-6446, and if you're out of town streaming live, it's 512-646-6446.
Three, that's a magic number. Three. It is, it's the magic number. Three. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born three, they stubbed me, and that's a magic number.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure. Measure in the music raises three parts. Casually see but don't do like the soul. Cause seeing and doing are actions for monkeys. Doing hip hop, hustle, no rock and roll. Unless your name's Brewster, cause Brewster's a punk. Parents let go cause there's magic in the air. Criticizing rap, cause you're out of order. Stop looking, listen to the phrase and Fred Astaire's. And don't get offended while Mace Do-Si-Do's your daughter. A dry camera roll system is now set. Fly around the store under Daisy production. It stands for the inner sound, y'all in your Quebec. That the action not a trick, but show me a function. Everybody wants to be a DJ. Everybody wants to be an MC. But being speakers are the best, and you don't have to guess. De La Soul Posse consists of three, and that's the magic number. This here piece of the pie is not dessert, but the cost that we dine. And three out of every darn time, the effect is, where the daisy grows in your mind. Showing true position, this here piece is kissing the part of the pie that's missing, where that negative number fills up the casualty. Maybe you can subtract it, you can call it your lucky partner, maybe you can call it your adjective. But odd as it may be, without my one and two, where would there be my three? Mace, Posse, me, and that's the magic number.
What does it all mean?
Focus is formed by flaunts of the soul. Souls who flaunt style gain praises by pounds. Common on speakers who honor the scroll. Scroll written daily creates a new sound. Listeners, listen, cause this here is wisdom. Wisdom of a speaker, a dub and a plug. Set aside a legal substance and feed them for now. Get them high off this dialect drug. Time is a factor, so it's time to count. Count not the negative actions of one. Speakers of soul say it's time to shout. Three forms the soul to a positive sum. Dance to this fix and flex every muscle. Space can be filled if you ride like my lumber. Advance to the tune, but don't do the hustle. Shake, rattle, roll to my magic number.
Now you may try to subtract it, but it just won't go away. Three times one.
What is it?
One, two, three.
Yeah. That's a magic number.
Yo, what's up?
One, two, three. And hey, children, what does it all mean?
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
One, two, three.
No more, no less.
That's a magic number.
No more, no less.
No more, no less.
No, 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 no more, no less. No more, no less. No more, no less.
Everybody in the audience ever get hit by a car?
No more, no less.
Oh, ain't that sweet. All right, everybody, that's De La Soul. Take a little break from me talking. let you hear a beat for a few minutes there. But so, yeah, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and all the interviews that I do on this show get posted up in the podcast at antiwar.com. It's the new Anti-War Radio project. I guess not so new anymore. We started in January. It's myself and the great Charles Goyette from Phoenix, Arizona, KFNX in Phoenix, AM 1100, I think it is. And we take all of his great interviews and all of my great interviews and put them up there in the podcast at antiwar.com. Also, you can check out all my archives at scotthortonshow.com. And my blog is thestressblog.com. Stop by the stress blog and give a shout, get in an argument with the crazy guys in the comment section. It's a lot of fun. So yeah, this is Anti-War Radio. The number, we have Ivan Elin coming on here in about 10 minutes, but in the meantime, we take a couple of calls. The number is 646-6446, 646-6446 here in Austin, Texas. And if you're out of town, call 512-646-6446. And let's go ahead and go to this call. Hi, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Yeah, are you there?
Yeah, I'm on the air. I'm calling from Angleton, about 40 miles south of Houston.
All right.
My name is Eric Dondero. I'm the chairman of the Libertarian Defense Caucus, which is a pro-war on Islamo-fascism libertarian group. I got your invitation. And I was a little confused at first because I thought, for some reason, I misread the invitation. I thought you were on Blog Talk Radio, but then I read the email again and found out you're an Austin radio station. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I guess it was Steve from the Stress Blog had passed on an invitation. This has been a topic of the show. Nice to meet you, by the way. I'm Scott. This has been a topic on the show lately is the failures of the libertarian movement, Libertarian Party, particularly to purge all the pro-war people out of the movement and remind people that libertarianism at its core is opposed to foreign interventionism. So I guess you would take issue with that, huh?
Not only would I take issue, I think it's kind of hilarious. We actually think the exact opposite. We're trying to purge all the anti-war people out of the libertarian movement because pro-war and pro-defense is actually the original correct libertarian position.
Barry
Goldwater is the founder of the libertarian movement.
No, he's not. Barry Goldwater
absolutely.
Is a conservative.
Barry Goldwater is the founder of the libertarian movement.
This is what you get.
Dana Raubacker, who's now a United States congressman from California, is sort of the co-founder of the libertarian movement. I give Dana the credit
for the political side
of the movement. Barry was kind of like the
Barry Goldwater,
philosophical guru.
Yeah, okay, no, see, Barry Goldwater, well, I guess the book was ghostwritten for him, but the title of it is The Conscience of a Conservative, and he took a libertarian... He took a libertarian foreign...
Many times later in life.
Anyway, he took a... just so you know, your mic's down so I can finish my sentence there. Barry Goldwater was a right-winger on foreign policy and was no libertarian whatsoever. He had a much more libertarian domestic policy than many Republicans. But if you asked him, he called himself a conservative, and he was surely not the founder of the libertarian movement. And he's still talking. He hadn't heard a word I said. I think it's hilarious that
you're not going to let me talk, then I don't see any sense in me calling in.
Well, that's what I was thinking was if you weren't going to let me respond to what you said.
The email here says, "Rest assured, you will be given time to speak. Respond to the host comments, and there's no name calling, hang-ups, or juvenile crap like that. Sincerely, Steve C."
Right,
I presume he's your producer.
Well, he's not. He's a friend though, and that's all right.
Okay.
But Eric, see, I demand the same respect. Right. So then if you say Goldwater was a libertarian and I want to say, no, he was a conservative, you don't get to just talk over me. Right. That's
well,
the way it works.
Like
it's my show.
To say anything. You've given me like 30 seconds to even make my point. Why don't you let me make my point before you even respond?
OK, tell me how Dana Rohrabacher is the founder of the libertarian movement.
Excellent question. Now, thank you for asking. OK, from 1966 to 1969. Dana Raubacher was the chairman of the Libertarian Caucus within Young Americans for Freedom. They used to have flag football games on the beaches of Orange County, California, between the what were called the laissez-faire's and the derogative term, which were the libertarians versus the traditionals, the trads, which were the conservatives. Dana was the captain of the football team.
Yeah, okay, that's all very interesting. Hey, tell me this.
Let me finish.
Are you still proud? Are you proud of your support for the war in Iraq that now the vast supermajority of the American people oppose and realize was a mistake? Are you still proud that you helped support a war
that
got hundreds of thousands of people killed?
Those are polls from left-wing media sources like the Washington Post and CNN.
I'm sorry, this is boring as shit, Eric. Forget it,
dude. Are you proud of hating your country? Proud of hating America?
I'm proud that I hate you, fool. Anyway, so yeah, thanks a lot, Steve, for, you know, what a fucking waste of my audience's time. Eric Dondero. Dude, you're a nobody, dude. And you don't represent libertarianism. Give me a fucking break. Anybody else wants to get involved on the air? 646-6446. And there I go, right into the juvenile shit, you know? Isn't it sad? Yeah, this is anti-war radio, and if you're pro-war, you're not a libertarian by definition, and there's no such thing as Islamo-fascism. And if you supported the war in Iraq, and you don't take it back, you're a dick. And that's just a fact. That's not a matter of opinion. I mean, give me a fucking break, dude. Where do they find these people? Steve, where do you find these people, man? Yahoo News. Few Americans trust military or media for information on Iraq. Thursday, April 5th. Most Americans have little or no confidence in the information they receive from the military or from the media about the situation in Iraq, according to a poll released Thursday. The survey by the Washington-based Pew Research Center for the People and the Press found that 52% have little or no faith in the military's portrayal of the four-year war, compared with 60% who feel the same way about the press reports of the conflict. The figures are a far cry from the overwhelming confidence Americans had in the military and the media at the outset of the war in March 2003. At the time, fully 85% said they had at least a fair amount of confidence in military information, and 81% were confident that the press was giving an accurate picture of the war. Michael DeMock, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center, said the poll findings mirror the public's perceptions of how well the war is going. People are questioning whether they are getting good information about how things are going, and it's affecting the public's confidence in the government and military, as well as the press. He noted differences along party lines in how people responded to the survey questions, with Democrats more skeptical about government information, whereas Republicans were more leery of the press. A survey of 1,038 adult Americans was conducted between March 30th and April 2nd and had a 3.5% plus or minus margin of error. So, the American people are so confused by that liberal media that they don't trust either. Yeah, it's the liberal media's fault that the American people don't support the war in Iraq anymore. What are you, stupid? And why would anybody doubt what the government tells them? From the Ross story, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice appears to be seeking to avoid testifying before a committee hearing concerning intelligence used to justify the Iraq war and other matters, according to a report in today's Washington Post. Al Kamen, author of the Post's In the Loop column, reported today that an assistant secretary of state wrote to Representative Henry Waxman and said the State Department had responded to most of the requests for information sent to the Secretary of State by the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. Our records reflect that you have sent 49 individual letters since 2003, 21 of which went to Rice, Jeffrey T. Bergner, Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs, wrote. And with the exception of one letter they haven't been able to find, and a few recent ones they're working on. She's responding to everything, the letter said, as Al Kamen reported today. Kamen added that because of these earlier replies, the State Department was hoping the April 18th hearing the House Committee had scheduled would be canceled. I'm sure that this thorough and comprehensive response, Department spokesman Sean McCormick said yesterday, will be sufficient to obviate the need for a formal hearing. While Kamen acknowledged to Ross Story that he had received the full letter yesterday, State Department spokeswoman Nancy Beck declined to release it, stating that it was congressional correspondence. A House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform staff member told Ross Story that the committee had just received the letter and was still evaluating whether or not it could be released. Ross Story reported last week on Representative Waxman's request that Secretary of State Rice testify before his committee. The letter asked her to be ready to testify regarding the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had sought uranium from Niger, White House treatment of classified information, the appointment of Ambassador Richard Jones as special coordinator for Iraq, and other subjects. So, yeah, that's what happens. It's a lot harder to ignore Henry Waxman when he's got the subpoena power and is the chairman of the committee. And, want to encourage him to keep following that story of that Niger uranium hoax, because there are a lot of unanswered questions, such as who really originally made them, and in cooperation and conjunction with who all, and how did that bogus information, which was used to lie the people of this country into war in Iraq, stay through the intelligence pipeline, even though the CIA had debunked it and removed it 14 separate times. How was it that those allegations were still used to lie the people of this country into war? Those questions have not all been answered. To some degree, they have, by some good reporters. But I sure would like to see Condoleezza Rice and Stephen Hadley and, hell, everybody who ever had a job in the Office of Special Plans for a single day called up before that committee to answer those questions. And here's another one. Speaking of, the justness and rightness of invading Iraq and the American people's doubts about that war. Hussein's, this is from the Washington Post today. Hussein's pre-war ties to Al-Qaeda discounted. Pentagon report, must not have been written by Abram Shulsky, huh? Says contacts were limited. captured Iraqi documents and intelligence interrogations of Saddam Hussein and two former aides all confirmed that Hussein's regime was not directly cooperating with al-Qaeda before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, according to a declassified Defense Department report released yesterday. The declassified version of the report by Acting Inspector General Thomas F. Gimbel also contains new details about the intelligence community's pre-war consensus that the Iraqi government and al-Qaeda figures had only limited contacts, and about its judgments that reports of deeper links were based on dubious or unconfirmed information. The report had been released in summary form in February. The report's release came on the same day that Vice President Cheney, appearing on Rush Limbaugh's radio program, repeated his allegation that al-Qaeda was operating inside Iraq before we ever launched, that's the direct quote, the war, under the direction of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the terrorist killed last June. God, Dick Cheney is such a liar, man! This is al-Qaeda, Eric Dondero, whoever the hell that is, his hero, Dick Cheney, is full of shit, man. This is al-Qaeda operating in Iraq, Cheney told Limbaugh's listeners about Zarqawi, who he said had led the charge for Iraq. Cheney cited the alleged history to illustrate his argument that withdrawing U.S. forces from Iraq would play right into the hands of al-Qaeda. Well, I don't know I guess I'll just keep reading here. Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Carl M. Levin, who requested the report's declassification, said in a written statement that the complete text demonstrates more fully why the Inspector General concluded that a key Pentagon office run by then Undersecretary of Defense Douglas J. Feith had inappropriately written intelligence assessments before the March 2003 invasion, alleging connections between al-Qaeda and Iraq, and that the United States intelligence consensus disputed. The report, in a passage previously marked secret, said Feith's office had asserted in a briefing given to Cheney's chief of staff, that is Scooter Libby, in September 2002, that the relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda was mature and symbiotic, marked by shared interest and evidenced by cooperation across 10 categories, including training, financing, and logistics. Instead, this new report said, the CIA had concluded in June 2002, and of course there was something else in the news just a few months ago about how George Bush was told specifically by the CIA in his morning briefing on September 15th or something, September 13th or 14th, that there was no real connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. He was informed of that on the very week of September 11th, so... they sent them back, and, you know, if you heard the interview with Michael Scheuer from just 2 or 3 weeks back, he was in charge of going through the CIA's evidence and rechecking it all, looking for substantive links between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and found none. So, apparently this is the report from 2002. Instead, the report said the CIA had concluded in June 2002 that there were few substantial contacts between al-Qaeda operatives and Iraqi officials, and had said that it lacked evidence of a long-term relationship like the ones Iraq had forged with other terrorist groups. Overall, the reporting provides no conclusive signs of cooperation on specific terrorist operations, that CIA report said, adding that discussions on the issue were necessarily speculative. The CIA had separately concluded that reports of Iraqi training on weapons of mass destruction were episodic, sketchy, or not corroborated in other channels, the Inspector General's report said. It quoted an August 2002 CIA report describing the relationship as more closely resembling two organizations trying to feel out or exploit each other, rather than cooperating operationally. The CIA was not alone, the defense report emphasized. The Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, had concluded that year, 2002, that available reporting is not firm enough to demonstrate an ongoing relationship between the Iraqi regime and al-Qaeda. But the contrary conclusions reached by Feith's office and leaked to the conservative, neoconservative, that is, former Trotskyite turned right-wing warmonger, Weekly Standard magazine before the war, were publicly praised by Cheney as the best source of information on the topic, a circumstance the Pentagon report cites in documenting the impact of what it described as inappropriate work. Feith has vigorously defended his work, accusing Gimbel of giving bad advice based on incomplete fact-finding and poor logic, and charging that the acting inspector general has been cheered on by the chairman of the Senate Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. In January, Feith's successor at the Pentagon, Eric Edelman, wrote a 52-page rebuttal to the inspector general's report that disputed its analysis and its recommendations for Pentagon reform. Cheney's public statements before and after the war about the risks posed by Iraq have closely tracked the briefings Fife's office prevented to the vice president's then chief of staff, I. Lewis Scooter Libby. That includes the briefing's depiction of an alleged 2001 meeting in Prague between an Iraqi intelligence official and one of the September 11, 2001 hijackers as one of eight known Iraq al-Qaeda contacts. The defense report states that at that time, now, dang, the intelligence community disagreed with the briefing's assessment that the alleged meeting constituted a known contact, a circumstance that the report said was known to Fife's office, but his office had bluntly concluded in a July 2002 critique of a CIA report on Iraq's relationship with al-Qaeda that the CIA's interpretation of the facts it cited ought to be ignored. In briefing, the briefing to Libby was also presented with slight variations to then-Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld, then-CIA Director George Tenet, and then-Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. It was prepared in part by someone whom the defense report described as a junior naval reservist, intelligence analyst detailed to Fife's office from the DIA. The person is not named in the report, but Edelman wrote that she was requested by Fife's office. The briefing, a copy of which was declassified and released yesterday by Carl Levin, goes so far as to state that, quote, fragmentary reporting points to possible Iraqi involvement not only in 9/11, but in previous al-Qaeda attacks. That idea was dismissed in 2004 by a presidential commission investigating the September 11th attacks, noting that no credible evidence existed to support it, which is probably the only thing that the 9/11 commission got right. Or in detail, anyway, when a senior intelligence analyst working for the government's counterterrorism task force obtained an early account of the conclusions by Fife's office, titled Iraq and Al-Qaeda Making the Case, the analyst prepared a detailed rebuttal calling it of no intelligence value and taking issue with 15 of 26 key conclusions, the report states. The analyst's rebuttal was shared with intelligence officers on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but evidently not with others. And, I'm sorry, I'm not going to finish this thing. The whole story that Cheney is still using, apparently, on the Rush Limbaugh show, that somehow Zarqawi amounts to the link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden is just pure fantasy. For one, Zarqawi didn't work for Osama bin Laden or associate himself with Osama bin Laden until January of 2004 at the earliest. I think it was January of 2004. But Loretta Napoleoni has detailed in her book, Zarqawi and the New Generation, what is it called? Shit. I can't remember. Anyway, Loretta Napoleoni wrote the book about Zarqawi, and she says, no, he met with bin Laden, and bin Laden said, look, I want you to do this and that, which I think primarily was, arrange tax in Europe. And Zarqawi said, no, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in overthrowing the King of Jordan. That's who my enemy is, King Abdullah. And so he left Afghanistan and was not part of al-Qaeda. And then when he went to Iraq, he wasn't with Saddam Hussein. He lived up in the Kurdish north, where he was protected by the American no-fly zone, no-drive zone, in the autonomous Kurdish north. And as Jim Mikleshevsky from NBC News reported, and a few others picked up the story after him and expanded it, the United States military tried to get permission to go in and kill Zarqawi and his Anwar al-Islam terrorist buddies in Kurdistan before the war, but Bush would not let them do it because that was all they had. Was this lie that somehow Zarqawi was the link between Saddam and bin Laden. And if he was dead, then there went their lie that Saddam was tied with al-Qaeda. And so they left him alive. And this is a guy, of course, who did a great deal to murder innocent people, American soldiers, and foment civil war in that country between the Sunni radicals and the Shiite radicals. And George Bush left him alive, and that was NBC News. Jim Mikleshevsky at NBC News, who's been their Pentagon reporter for years and years and years. And it wasn't the liberal media that said it. It was the generals. It was, you know, the brass who told this story to Jim Mikleshevsky. You know, he didn't go down to the local meeting of the Pinko Commie, panty waist fairy meeting to find out this information. He learned it from guys at the Pentagon. So, anyway, that's a bunch of crap. Dick Cheney's a liar. Still, he's a liar. And that article, Case Closed, in the Weekly Standard, that's based on Doug Feith's manufactured lies from the Office of Special Plans, pure BS. I mean, here Saddam Hussein had an airplane, a rundown old airplane, where he was training his police on counterterrorism. How to board an airplane quickly and kill the terrorists and secure the passengers and whatever. And yet, to the Office of Special Plans, oh no, this airplane can only mean one thing. Saddam Hussein is training terrorists how to hijack airplanes. Yeah, right. And then they tortured that poor guy Al-Libi into saying it was so. Maybe they got the Egyptians to torture Al-Libi into saying, yeah, that's what that airplane was for training us how to do hijackings. Yeah, and the you know, nails under his fingernails, the screws in his thumbs surely had nothing to do with that. Gee whiz, I was expecting a call in from Ivan Elin from the Independent Institute here to discuss Syria, so I think I'm going to play y'all some music and see if I can get old Ivan on the phone. So why don't you bear with me? This is Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. How do you like them apples? okay, I know. That's really more of an end-of-the-show kind of song there, right? That's, of course, Brutality Incorporated, Pressure Drop there. And I do believe I have the Independent Institute's Ivan Eland on the phone. Is that you, Ivan?
Yes, that's me.
Author of The Empire Wears No Clothes. Thanks, Ivan.
Thanks.
My friends, this has been Anti-War Radio. Thank you very much for listening, and sorry for going all Bill O'Reilly on that guy, but I just don't want to hear it. Give me a break, you know? Come on. All right, thanks again, Ivan Eland, and we'll see y'all Monday. Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas.